You may have heard this weekend the public government-run health insurance option is no longer, quote, an essential element to Obamacare.
The fact of the matter is there are not the votes in the United States Senate for the public option. There never have been. So to continue to chase that rabbit, I think, is just a wasted effort.
Well, North Dakota Democrat Senator Kent Conrad, you know what? We're still hunting rabbits here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 18th. John Hockenberry is away. I'm Andrea Bernstein here with Amy Holmes.
Good morning, Andrea. Coming up this hour, leading indicators say the worst of the recession may be over. You know what else is over? Campaigning in the Afghan elections. And we explore the limits of free speech. Plus, we have former Democratic Party chairman and former governor of Vermont, Howard Dean, joining us on the show.
Dr. Howard Dean.
But first, we're here with Art Kaplan, a professor of bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, to talk about healthcare. Okay, Art, so this is so confusing. We have buzzwords. We have Sarah Palin launching the phrase death panels. The administration said boo, but now end-of-life counseling is out of the plan. So who scored on that?
Lack of evidence, bad rhetoric, but I'd have to say Sarah Palin scored big on that. The counseling for end-of-life care probably out of the plan.
Okay, stay with us, Art. We're going to finish this conversation in just a moment, but first, today's top headlines.
At the White House today, the focus is on the Middle East. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak is meeting with President Obama to discuss ways to restart stalled peace talks. Overseas, NATO says it will halt offensives in Afghanistan during the country's presidential election on Thursday. Instead, NATO troops will be stationed around the country to help protect voters.
That comes as the UN says two of its staff members were killed in a bombing in Kabul today. The Afghan government says several civilians were killed as well, and dozens more were injured. In neighboring Pakistan, the spokesperson for the Taliban there has been captured. He told interrogators that Taliban leader Batullah Massoud was killed in a U.S. missile strike earlier this month. Several other Taliban leaders have said Massoud was still alive. Meanwhile, the U.S. Army is planning to require all soldiers to undergo intensive mental stress training. It's meant to stop mental health problems, including depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. And turning to physical health, only 45 million doses of the H1N1 vaccine will be ready by October. That's less than half of what was initially predicted. The government says it's because of a shortage due to manufacturing issues.
Hurricane Bill is getting bigger out in the Atlantic. Right now, the storm is 300 miles across. It may come close to hitting Bermuda by week's end. Watch out for some fresh economic data out later this hour. We'll learn the number of houses that started construction last month, as well as the producer price index. On Wall Street yesterday, all major indices fell more than 2%. The Dow starts trading today at 91.35. The S&P kicks off at 980. The NASDAQ opens at 1931. And we here are creating a healthcare glossary at the Takeaway. Now, Amy, what healthcare term do you want to know more about?
Co-ops. I just don't understand that issue at all.
The public option, nonprofits, the Swiss option. Gary emails us that he'd like us to define the word bailout because it seems like the insurance companies are getting bailed out and protected if we don't reform healthcare. What's your word? And maybe you have your own definition for a phrase you've been hearing during the debate or on The Takeaway. Give us that too. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Amy Holmes. I'm here with Andrea Bernstein, and we're in for John Hockenberry. Okay, Andrea, this gets so confusing. Co-ops, nationalization, socialization, death panels. Can you sort it all out?
You know, I have to say that I was following, but then I feel like the sort of nonprofit healthcare cooperative was just kind of dropped into the debate, and now I've got to sort of dust off my memory. Like, what does that mean, and how does it compare to the public option, and has it worked anywhere in the world?
Well, fortunately, we have producers who help us with that, and they gave us Art Kaplan, director of the Center of Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He is the author of the Penn Guide to Bioethics. He's been involved with health reform since the Clinton administration. He's joining us from his home in Philadelphia. Thank you. Good morning.
Yeah, hoping not to be involved with health reform into the next century, as a matter of fact.
I hope we don't have this same discussion again in another 15 years.
So for a while there, Art, the debate was pretty caught up on a couple of buzzwords. Let's take a listen.
Sarah Palin now joining the fray with a posting on her Facebook page saying, quote, the America I know and love is not one in which my parents or my baby with Down syndrome will have to stand in front of Obama's death panel so his bureaucrats can decide whether they are worthy of health care. Such a system is downright evil.
So the word evil, pretty passionate, inflamed language there. What was Sarah Palin talking about when she said death panel?
Well, in one sense, it's difficult to know. I think she was being political rather than realistic. There was a provision in this legislation that passed the House that said something pretty simple and easy to understand and not very evil. It said, let's pay doctors to have conversations with patients about end-of-life care planning, about what happens when they're terminally ill. It's something that you should do, I should do, everybody should do. We should talk about living wills. We should talk about what we want, whether we want a lot of care or a little care, or who we want to make decisions for us. The legislation basically said doctors don't do it now because they don't get paid to do it. Let's pay them.
But Art, you're a bioethicist. What about the criticism that government should not be incentivizing doctors to potentially be telling people, look, if you want to hang on, it's going to be really expensive, and so you should have a do not resuscitate order?
Well, I think that was the fear, and Sarah Palin was expressing it, that government bureaucrats would tell these docs, look, budget's getting out of hand, costs are out of control in this new health reform, say goodbye to grandpa. It never was part of that. It's pretty simple. You were just supposed to get paid for conversation. And if somebody didn't want to have a conversation, they don't have to. I think this particular provision ought to stay in the bill. It needs to be made very clear and put into English, maybe what I just said, but it's at some risk of disappearing because of the fear that's been stirred up about it.
So, Art Kaplan, you were saying you hope we're not having this discussion again in another 15 years. What is it about healthcare that when you start talking about these issues, all of these buttons get pushed and people, as you say, are sort of not talking about what actually happens, but about their fears?
Well, three things. First, we are a country that wants to believe that the market can solve all allocation problems, including resource allocation in healthcare. There's been market failure for a long time, but a lot of people ideologically just don't want to buy that. So that leads us to a kind of huge political fight about the value of the market, not really about health reform. Second, as you all have said, health reform is certainly one of the most engaging, clear, and most fun topics to get into the details of. You can hear people passing out and hitting the floor as we talk about it. That's trouble. And third, health reform, I think, in the U.S. has always been a problem because we have a lot of people covered, and it's a minority that aren't. It's hard for the to get into this discussion without worrying that they're going to lose something to the have-nots.
So, Art, let's get into another buzzword that we're hearing a lot about, co-ops. What is a co-op? How does this work?
I have to tell you, as soon as I heard the co-op posed as an alternative to the government plan, I was laughing because it sounds like something out of old Soviet socialism. You know, we're all going to join the co-op.
But it's actually been, out on the kibbutz.
Exactly.
<right?
laughs> But it's actually been put up as an alternative to a government plan. Basic idea is private insurers contract with doctors and hospitals and supply insurance coverage to people. It's kind of what Blue Cross does now. Key differences, got to be not-for-profit, has to be heavily regulated by the government to be a co-op that makes sense. And what I mean there is, if you have a pre-existing condition, some disease, some problem that puts you at risk, you can't be written out of the plan, and government is going to have to subsidize the
but
co-op.
I have a question for you. Co-ops already exist, so why do we need the federal government to get involved?
Because the ones that exist leave about a quarter of Americans unable to buy into them. They're too expensive. The feds have to subsidize the cost to make it affordable, have to lay out a package of services that's affordable, kind of like auto insurance. What's the basic plan going to be? And then they have to step in and say, look, you can't get people and boot them out of the plan because they cost too much. You still got to put everybody in. If you don't have those things in place, regulating the co-op, then you're just reinventing the current system, and that still leaves us with a quarter of the American population that can't buy in.
So what is the relative advantage or disadvantage of a co-op versus a public option? And if a co-op is just as good, why didn't Obama just go right to that?
I think the public option's a little better because it cuts down cost and overhead. Public option would be Medicare. Overhead on Medicare to run the system in terms of administrative cost is about one-tenth what it costs to run U.S. healthcare or Aetna, not paying big executive salaries, not throwing billboards up everywhere, not advertising. It's just a pretty simple government plan that works. So better buy on the, if you will, government-run plan that people could buy into. But there's a fear that that would kill the private insurers. They couldn't compete because of this big government subsidy. So the co-op is a compromise saying, well, how about a semi-government plan? Think of it as halfway there. Going to be regulated, but not quite government-run.
So I want to bring in one of our listeners. We got a call from Martina in Kankakee, Illinois, and she called to clarify that she believes health care, medical treatment, and health insurance are all very different things.
Lumping all these together as health care has created very basic, instinctual, and emotional responses to any perceived threats to physical well-being or financial status when we do not operate from common definitions or understanding.
And let me address that to you, Art. For example, you know, we don't have the Canadian system or the UK system, but it's also been said all Americans do indeed get health care. So what is it we're talking about?
What we're talking about is getting people out of the emergency room when they're very, very sick and have waited too long to wind up there for basic health problems that should have been seen much earlier and in a different setting. That ER focus we have with the jammed up emergency rooms costs us a bundle. People get there way too sick. What we're really talking about with health insurance is letting people pay to go to a primary care doc, family doc, internist, gynecologist.
And you know who would agree with you?
You
know who would agree with you actually is former Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, who we interviewed on about this, and he said that our primary care system is not as good as it could be. Another buzzword, another buzz phrase, national health care versus socialized health care. What's the difference? What are people talking about?
Socialized health care is when everybody's in the same pool, everybody's covered by a government plan, and the government pays the docs, pays the hospitals. Closest thing to that in the universe is probably the British health system. It's not even the Chinese health system. It's probably Britain. But nationalized health care is when the government is trying to regulate the system. Switzerland, Germany, for example, both are countries that cover everybody, but they have private insurance, so the government is regulating the system closely. Nationalized means closely monitored by the government. Socialized means absolutely run by the government.
Now, let's also get into the phrase the uninsured. We hear numbers tossed around, 47 million, 50 million, but then we hear other people say there's the hardcore, there are the young people. What does this number really mean?
Uninsured is a problem that arises for two reasons. It's people who aren't poor enough to qualify for Medicaid, so they're just working poor, but they don't get insurance as part of their job. Walmart, McDonald's, those kind of places. You're not pulling health insurance as a benefit. So a lot of working people don't get health insurance coverage. Other group are the people who just came out of college. They're off their parents' plan. They may or may not have a job yet. They may be wandering around graduate school, for all I know. They may be wandering around the streets of the United States.
They may be wandering in this studio.
Right. Whatever they're doing as interns or whatever, they're not covered by health insurance. Those are the big groups. We're not talking about some population of slackers. We're talking about people who work part-time or just work at jobs that can't afford the benefit.
And let me ask you very quickly, I know there's a fear that it also includes people who are not American citizens.
That's a bogus fear. No one is talking at this time about trying to extend health insurance coverage to immigrants. That comes up every once in a while as a sort of Lou Dobbs-like horrific story. You're probably not going to let an immigrant drop dead in the street. You'll lug him into the ER, but we're not going to provide insurance for illegal aliens in this plan. No one's talking about it.
Well, this is a fascinating discussion. I look forward to having more of this discussion with you, Art Kaplan. Thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Thank you. That was Art Kaplan, director of the Center of Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of The Penn Guide to Bioethics. Go and buy it. And he's been involved with health reform since way back in the Clinton administration.
Tom DeLay is coming up next.
Wow, Tom DeLay, formerly the Hammer, now Mr. Twinkle Toes.
He's going to be dancing with you, Amy.
One can only hope.
Have to watch it on the web.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Live from Hollywood, this is Dancing with the Stars.
And live from Houston, Texas, on the road is former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, who will be starring on Dancing with the Stars. Thank you so much for joining us, Congressman.
Well, thank you. I don't know about starring on Dancing with the Stars, but I'm going to be dancing.
So I have to ask you, you're going to be going from the Hammer to Tommy Twinkletoes. Are you ready for that?
don't do that to me.
Another question
we'll
I have to ask.
We'll see if I got twinkle toes later on when I learn how to dance.
So another question, of course, everybody wants to know. Are you looking forward to those costume fittings with all the sequins?
Sequins are up for negotiation. Pink color is up for negotiation. I do the paso doble in white tie and tails.
And, of course, as a Texan, you're going to be up against Dallas Cowboy Michael Irwin. Does it break your heart that you're going to have to break him over your knee?
Now, that's what people are going to find out. I never had to break a leg to get a vote. What I did was woo people and grow the vote. So maybe I can woo Michael into defeat.
So, of course, there is a serious question to all of this. I'm sure you've heard the criticism. Congressman, you're under indictment. And some people speculate that this is a way to try to win public sympathy and public support in potentially an upcoming trial. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, I can't get to trial. This is nothing but modern-day politics. My political opponents indicted me on laws that don't exist in Texas, and I can't get to trial. But that, be that as it may, I don't care about that anymore. I've pushed that all behind me, and I'm moving on. I'm moving on and away from the politics of personal destruction.
So, Congressman DeLay, this is Andrea Bernstein. If it wasn't to rehabilitate your image, what made you want to do this?
I was asked. The producers, I guess on a lark, called me up and wanted to know if I'd be interested, and it took me about 15 minutes after talking to my wife and my daughter. I love to dance. I've
only 15 minutes?
I'm a fan of Dancing with the Stars. First of all, to be called by the producers was quite an honor, and to be asked is just outrageous. And, of course, I'm going to take them up on it and learn how to ballroom dance and just have a good time.
So have you gotten into the training yet?
I'm driving to it right now. I get my partner in about 30 minutes.
And do you have dance training in your background?
Sure. I took disco lessons. I danced when I was a kid in Venezuela.
The Hustle? From the Hammer to the Hustle. Right?
Hammer to the Hustle. Maybe that's it. Keep trying.
That may be the takeaway. What's your favorite dance?
Actually, the waltz is my favorite dance, Texas waltz. But I love the polka, Texas two-step, and I really enjoy disco.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question about politics, but first, as a fan of the show, you must know that some of those female dancers that you'll be paired up with are, you know, pretty hot. I mean, is your wife going to get a little jealous when you get close to them?
Nah, my wife is really looking forward to this. Dancing with the Stars is a family show, and they do everything with great taste. And yeah, they use beautiful people, and that just makes it more fun.
So getting to politics, as an outsider, and you're watching, of course, the town halls and the healthcare debate unfolding, how do you think Republicans are faring in all of this?
Oh, I think they're doing very well. I really appreciate what they're doing. I appreciate mostly the American people coming out and expressing themselves. They are not buying into this Obamacare, and they're expressing themselves, and that's now into the psyche of Democrat congressmen.
But what about the criticism that Republicans can't just be the party of no, that they need to come up with their own proposals?
Well, they're not the party of no. They have come up with their proposals. Unfortunately, the media won't talk about it. all they want to talk about is Obama. The Republicans have a proposal. They have many proposals. The Democrats choose not to listen to the Republicans at all, and their fate is pretty much dictated because they won't listen. And they're going to lose.
Well, we had...
And go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. No, I was going to say, we had Howard Dean on the show earlier today, and he predicted that the final reform would have a government-run public option. Do you foresee that?
Yeah, no. It won't pass. He's once again... Howard Dean is dreaming dreams. Public option will not pass through the Senate. It will have a hard time getting through the House now. And if it doesn't get through, then they're going to have a very tough time passing the bill, because all the liberals will vote against it if there's no public option.
But
leadership of the House and the Senate and the president are in a terrible situation right now.
Tom DeLay, the Democrats won the election. They control Congress. Shouldn't they get to have the, you know, isn't that the will of the American people for them to get the health care plan that they want?
No, the will of the American people is being expressed right now. And the politicians are responding to it.
But isn't
the American people didn't vote for this, and they finally realize it.
I guess we're gonna have to see about that. But it seems to me, having covered the election, that the American people did think they were voting for health care reform.
Not this health care reform. They were voting for the health care reform that Obama was talking about. And when you get down to the details, as we now are, the American people are rejecting it.
So, Congressman DeLay, your take on Obama, do you think that he really did promise a centrist health care reform, or do you think he's pulled a bait and switch?
These typical liberals, they say one thing, and when their actions prove differently, the American people wake up. That's exactly what's going on here.
Isn't that what the Republicans are doing here, though? I mean, the Republicans are sort of, you know, attacking all of these things, but are promoting plans that might bust spending. Aren't we all playing politics?
I didn't hear all of what you said, but the Republicans are stating their position. They have alternatives that are real reform, alternatives that are market-based, not government-based, and the American people are participating in the debate now.
Congressman, I gotta cut in.
Obama is losing.
Quick question: are you a little bit country or a little bit rock and roll?
I'm a lot country.
Thank you.
But I'm gonna learn rock and roll.
Congressman DeLay on the phone with us, Dancing with the Stars.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Amy Holmes, and I'm here with Andrea Bernstein, and we're filling in for John Hockenberry. So, Andrea, we've been following very closely the Afghanistan elections, presidential elections on Thursday. Campaigning has officially ended, but this may be the quiet before the storm. We have with us Glenn Cowan, an international election observer working for Democracy International, an American-based organization that manages democracy and governance programs internationally. He joins us from Kabul, Afghanistan. So, Glenn, you're going to be on the ground. What are your main concerns?
The principal concern that we have for our international election observers is that the security situation here does not become so serious that it impedes our ability to help the Afghan people in promoting the integrity of these elections. We are managing that threat by providing good security for our 60 international monitors.
So, Glenn, tell us about some of the preparations that you've been taking.
Our principal preparation is to make certain that we have recruited international observers who are experienced. Many of them have worked in Afghanistan before, or they've certainly worked in the region. We then provide them with a good deal of physical security. They have professional security advisors with them all the time, and they are diligent in the way they approach making their appointments, who they visit with, how they go about having these conversations.
So, Glenn, you know, just practically speaking, are you wearing body armor?
We have body armor with us. We have helmets with us. We have armed security with us. As we approach polling stations and as we have gone to interviews, we do not wear our body armor to those interviews. We will not wear body armor in the polling stations. We do have a responsibility to the Afghan voter not to create more problems than we're here to try to help solve. So we maintain a very low security profile when we're in the presence of the election places and the voters.
So, Glenn, we recently spoke to the Afghanistan ambassador to the United States, and he had some interesting things to say about the possibility that President Karzai may try to buy the vote. I want you to listen to this clip.
So if he is winning, why there will be a need for him to rig the vote? As you have seen it on the poll, he has at least a 20% margin over the next running mate in Afghanistan. But all of us should work hard to make sure that this election is transparent, and if there are concerns, I think they should be addressed through the election commissions, through our friends in the international community. There will be 600 monitors in Afghanistan, and even if some person is able to buy a few a voting card, but only one person will be able to vote once.
So as an election observer, what do you make of that?
We bring to this observation experience running back over 25 years, and in many countries we're accustomed to the charges that there will be manipulation of the process or that there will be cheating. We understand all of the ways in which that can be accomplished and are prepared to try to deter such actions in the first instance, but if not, to be able to detect them and to report on them accurately.
So are you confident that this election will be credible?
I think the first criterion is whether or not the environment is secure enough to permit the voters to go to the polls, and that I can't conjecture on. If I think back to Pakistan a year ago, where we led an international election observation, and in the 5 and 6 days leading up to the 18 February poll there were 20 or 30 instances of bombing and suicide attacks in the country, and there was huge concern as to whether or not the voters would be able to go to the polls. And on election morning, as I expect may be the case here, turnout was very light initially as the voters assessed whether or not it was safe to approach the polls. Once they recognized that they could, in Pakistan at least, they turned out in very large numbers. So I wouldn't be surprised if what you see here is a slow start to the process, and then as voters make conclusions about the security environment, the turnout will get larger.
So very quickly, Glenn, another question that I know we've had all week. Are women a particular security concern in this election cycle?
I think the men in the household are concerned about women family members, and one of the reasons for a slow turnout in the morning is that the men in the household want to wait and see what the security environment is before feeling comfortable having women members of the household go to vote.
Glenn Cowan, I want to thank you so much for joining us. That was Glenn Cowan, an international election observer working for Democracy International. Now we're going to be bringing in Martin Patience, BBC correspondent in Afghanistan, who joins us from Mazar-e-Sharif, Afghanistan. Martin, thanks for coming in.
Not at all.
So let's talk about the story we're reporting on, Afghan elections. Is this the calm before the storm now that campaigning has stopped?
Well, it's very difficult to know, obviously, what's going to happen on Thursday. We have had two big attacks inside the heart of Kabul, the capital city, which is about 250 miles away from where I am currently. And I think those attacks are significant because they have a psychological impact. If the insurgents, and they said they want to disrupt this process, if they can strike in the heart of the city, the heart of the capital, then I think it's fair to say they could strike almost anywhere in the country, and that's of real concern, I think, to Afghan voters, so, particularly in the south and the east, where the insurgency is at its strongest.
So, Martin, characterize for us, you know, here in the States, what is the mood? Is there tension in the air? Does it feel like people are sort of coiled up, waiting for the next bomb?
Well, it depends where you are in the country. I was in the south a month ago, and it's incredibly tense down there. There's British and American soldiers, tens of thousands of them deployed down there. There's improvised explosive devices. It's incredibly dangerous. Now, in the capital, Kabul, the security situation, although we have seen two attacks recently, is generally speaking pretty good. It's a normal city. It's a bustling city. There's commerce going on. People go to work. Children go to school. And now I'm up in the north, and actually the north is the most relaxed of all of them. you know, the roads are good, there's electricity, business is booming. I was just in a factory today, a tomato factory, which produces 300,000 bottles a month, which it exports to the neighbouring countries. So it depends where you are in Afghanistan. There are parts which are incredibly violent, but there are other parts, particularly where I am now, which are actually thriving.
So quickly, yes or no, I know it's hard to say, but are Afghanis optimistic about these elections or cynical?
Yes and no. I think it's 50-50. Again, it depends where you are in the country and if the government has a presence there. Certainly here in the north, they seem to be optimistic. In the south, I think there's a greater degree of pessimism.
Well, Martin, I want to thank you so much for coming in and joining us and giving us a lay of the land. That was Martin Patience with the BBC from Afghanistan.
And a quick look at the headlines just out. Wholesale prices fell by 9.9% in July. That pushed annual wholesale inflation to a record low. And construction of new homes dipped slightly below expectations last month in a sign the building industry's recovery could be bumpy. New construction of homes and apartments fell 1% last month. Hurricane Bill may hit near Bermuda by the end of the week, but it's too early to tell if the Category 2 storm threatens the eastern U.S. That's what we're watching today. Coming up, Amy, it seems like the public option might be dropped. You know who's not too happy about that? Howard Dean. Remember him? Doctor, former presidential candidate. We're going to hear from him in about 10 minutes.
Hopefully a yowl.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Andrea Bernstein.
I'm Amy Holmes. So, Andrea, you know, I remember when I went back to school, the flu wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, you kind of put up with it, right? You got a sore throat. Sniffly nose, not that big of a deal, but...
When was that, 1918?
It was a while, but it seems like this year it's being taken far more seriously with the swine flu swirling about, and it could be a much more dangerous epidemic. With us to talk about it is Dr. Maria Simbra. She's a medical reporter for KDKA-TV in Pittsburgh. Doctor, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So why is the flu this year so different?
Right. Well, you know, flu season is just months away, and the new element, as you mentioned, this year is the H1N1, or swine flu. So as they do in public health, they're preparing for the worst, but hoping for the best. So right now, they're looking at the southern hemisphere very closely, because it's flu season there right now. So places like Australia, India, they're watching how the virus is spreading, how the illness behaves, and, you know, taking precautions. I saw some reports of school closings in India. You know, you're talking about school just a moment ago. And, you know, they want to prevent the spread of H1N1 through the schools. There is a concern that perhaps the virus will mutate over the summer and become a deadlier strain in the fall. But we haven't seen any evidence of that happening. And there was a report just this past week in the Journal of the American Medical Association showing that... they were looking at pandemics all the way back to the 16th century, and most of the time that is not the pattern. There is not this resurgence in the fall. Also, they've been looking at the virus itself. There's news yesterday that the virus apparently isn't very sticky, so it doesn't attach to the insides of your respiratory systems very easily, which explains why we're seeing little bursts of outbreaks here and there, but no sustained transmission.
So, Doctor, you're saying they. Are we talking about the CDC? Who is they?
Researchers are looking at the virus. Public health officials are watching the epidemiology. So the CDC, the World Health Organization, they're watching the patterns.
So what does this mean to parents who are listening to this broadcast right now who are sending their kids off to school? Should they be concerned, worried? I mean, this is a lot of scary talk.
Right. Yeah. You know, because children are known to be spreaders of the flu, they are going to be a target group for immunization against the swine flu. So they are looking at doing in-school vaccination programs. You can imagine this would be a very large undertaking. The Associated Press did a review of swine flu planning, and they estimate this would involve 3 million students. And just thinking about the logistics, it's going to be quite complex. You're going to need permission slips for all the kids. You're going to have healthcare professionals watching the kids for reactions. There's a question of whether parents need to be present during the immunizations. So these are things that each school district will have to work out.
So if you're a parent and you've been hearing about H1N1 swine flu, what symptoms, really quickly, top three, should you be looking for?
Sure. Fever, cough, and shortness of breath have been the most prominent symptoms in people who have been hospitalized with this. Early on, the first few cases, there was prominent nausea and vomiting, but we haven't seen that so much in the United States. Also, fever is another symptom to watch for.
So is your takeaway that this is something that, you know, we'll have flu this fall? Parents, don't be worried. Just get your kids vaccinated.
It is definitely a concern. I think most people are saying that we are going to see H1N1 this flu season. Vaccines are in development. They should be available in mid-October.
Thank you, Dr. Simbra, medical reporter for KDKA-TV in Pittsburgh.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Andrea Bernstein here with Amy Holmes. Coming up, Dr. Howard Dean joins us, and he's fighting for a public option for healthcare. We'll go to him in just a few minutes, but we're also creating a healthcare glossary here at The Takeaway. What healthcare term do you want to know more about? Healthcare co-ops? Health insurance reform? Maybe you have your own definitions.
Medical fraud. When the doctors want you to take tests and they know you don't need them. When administrators earn millions of dollars and they haven't provided any health care. Medical fraud. Add that word to the glossary.
Add your word. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, a look at today's top news stories.
President Obama meets with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in the White House today. Later, he's scheduled to meet with former President Bill Clinton. Overseas, former South Korean President Kim Dong-jung has died at 85. During his lifetime, he survived imprisonment and several suspected assassination attempts. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2000 for his efforts to reconcile with communist North Korea.
Israel has put a temporary hold on new building projects in the West Bank. That's according to the Israeli government officials who spoke to the Associated Press. Officially, Israel has refused to honor a request from a U.S. to stop all construction there.
A former government informant has been indicted in the largest identity theft case ever. Albert Gonzalez stole 130 million credit card and debit card numbers, hard to imagine, by hijacking into the networks of supermarket and convenience store chain stores. Gonzalez is already awaiting trial on other hacking charges. Those are just some of the news stories we're watching today.
Amy, the public option in healthcare reform, that was just a teeny tiny part of healthcare reform,
right? Oh, tiny, minuscule.
This is what the president said this weekend.
The public option, whether we have it or we don't have it, is not the entirety of healthcare reform. This is just one sliver of it, one aspect of it. And by the way, it's both the right and the left that have become so fixated on this that they forget everything else.
That comment and others like it from Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius have drawn a lot of attention, in no small part from Howard Dean, the former governor of Vermont, one-time presidential candidate, and the former chair of the Democratic National Committee. He's also a doctor. Howard Dean joins us this morning for his thoughts on reform. Good morning, Governor. Welcome
to
The Takeaway.
Thank you.
I just got back from your lovely state. How beautiful it is.
It's lovely, and now it's about 95 degrees here.
You must be a very happy person living
in
Vermont.
Nice. We had a lot of rain for a while, and now it's a great summer.
So maybe a little bit unhappy about what the president said in Grand Junction.
I'm not very worried about it. I think at the end of the day, we're going to have a health care bill, and we're going to have a public option in the health care bill. The truth is, you can't do cost controls, and you really can't really do health reform without a public option. So, and the public option is not so complicated, really. I think they've had some trouble explaining it, but it's very simple. Just let people under 65 get into Medicare. That's basically what it is. It's not quite exactly right, but that's pretty much it.
We had a guest at the top of the show, Art Kaplan, who seemed to think that a healthcare cooperative would be okay. Also, it would be a regulated nonprofit that would perform essentially the same function. Why don't you think that?
Because we've tried it before. Blue Cross Blue Shield used to be something like that. It was a nonprofit. It used to be have public members on the board, but they got eaten up by the private insurance industry. Yesterday on Wall Street, the stocks went down almost 200 points, but the health insurance stocks went up. Now, why do you suppose that is? Those people on Wall Street aren't so dumb. They know that the funneling $60 billion worth of government money into the health insurance companies is going to get them a lot of money. And the co-ops are going to get crushed, just like Blue Cross is now mostly a private health insurance company. and they behave toward their patients and their doctor and the doctors just the way the private health insurance industry does. That is, they cut you off your insurance if you get sick, or they don't let you have any insurance, or they won't insure sick people, and they charge you more. It's not good for the country, and it's very, very expensive. This is not going to work without a public option.
Governor Dean, this is Amy Holmes here. Just to clarify, you believe in the final version of this that we will not have co-ops, we will have a government-run option.
You will have a government-run option because you have no choice. Look, Massachusetts has done a terrific job getting people insured. Only 2.5% of their people don't have insurance. That's comparable to a lot of European countries. But they don't have a public option, and their program is going broke. You have to have the public option in order to control crime.
Now, why is the public so unsure about the public option?
Because people have made all kinds of manners of lies. You know, the president himself got such a kick out of one of the little old ladies who got up and said, "Keep your government hands off my Medicare." Well, Medicare is a single payer run by the government. So the right wing has said all these things, and people don't know. Healthcare is so complicated that they believe this stuff if it doesn't get refuted right away, and so that's what happened.
But why hasn't it been? I mean, this is, you know, President Obama, master campaigner. I mean, you yourself in your campaign, you were all about getting people mobilized, getting people involved. Why hasn't that happened with healthcare reform?
I think it's because it's very hard to understand, and it hasn't been clear from the beginning how important the public option was. In order to mobilize people, you really have to have a very clear program and very clear lines. And the other thing is, it's easy to mobilize people when it's us and them. And the Republicans have set themselves up to be them because of their own catering to their own base. Obviously, they've made up enormously crazy things, euthanasia, abortion, on and on and on and on.
But Governor Dean, let me talk about
But our side didn't see that because they didn't really know what we were doing.
Let me talk a little bit about the us and them within the Democratic Party. Okay.
Yeah.
So when you were chair of the DNC, Rahm Emanuel, the current chief of staff, he was a big critic of yours with the 50-state strategy, and it looked like you were right. The Democrats in the House have a 54-seat majority. You control the Senate with 60 votes. You have 29 governorships. What do you think about that?
I think it's great to have 29 governorships and all those seats, but the seats don't do any good in Congress if you can't use them for anything. And one of the mistakes my party made for a long time when they were losing is to try to be more like the people that were beating them. It was actually called the Stockholm Syndrome from the stuff that used to go on during the war, when the captors would identify with their captives would identify with their captors. And the Democrats did that for a long time. Well, you can't do that. You've got to set out a clear identity and stand up for what you believe in.
But Governor Dean, that same captive is the president's chief of staff, who's advising him to negotiate on the public option.
Well, you know, I'm not going to get into what's going on in the White House because I don't think anybody knows what the chief of staff is advising the president. I think they keep that private.
Well, we do. He said it out loud.
Pardon me?
He said it out loud. He said that the public option was negotiable at the very beginning of this debate.
Well, you know, he can say what he wants. He's the chief of staff. But I think without the public option, it's not real reform, and I don't think it'll pass.
Now, the situation that you described...
Anthony Weiner, who's a member of the House, just said there's 100 Democrats who will vote against the bill if that's not in it. Stick with the one that brought you. Stick with the Democrats. Stick with the folks that... the Republicans have no interest in this bill, and you're not going to get more than 2 or 3 votes at the most in the whole, both the House and the Senate. Let's just have a good bill. Let's do what Franklin Roosevelt did. We got Social Security through without a single Republican vote, and we picked up votes in 1936. That's the way to approach things.
Now, but
do the right thing.
The Stockholm Syndrome that you were describing, that sounds an awful lot like the Obama administration strategy on health care, which is to make an awful lot of concessions to Republicans who, in the short history of this administration, haven't shown themselves prone to voting with anything the Obama administration wants.
Well, I think the president's trying very, very hard. Look, the American people are sick of the ugliness of the Republicans, appealing to anger all the time. I think the new generation that elected President Obama, this is the first president of the under 35 generation. They elected him. The more people under 35 went to the polls than people over 65. And I think they want to have people who work together. The trouble is the Republicans are kind of this old rump party that's doing things the old ways, and they don't believe in bipartisanship. And it's almost impossible to have a bipartisan bill
In fairness, what about those blue dogs who are also saying?
The blue dogs have been very helpful. We need a conservative and moderate influences on this bill because this is a country with lots of different kinds of people in it, and the Republicans aren't being serious about it, and the blue dogs are, and that's very helpful. And I think the House bill became a better bill because of the blue dogs.
Thank you very much, Governor Howard Dean, former governor of Vermont, former Democratic presidential candidate, and former head of the DNC.
Oh, boy, I wish we could have him on for longer, but we also got an email from you. Spence emails us, quote, "I hope Howard Dean is right, but he seems like he's living on a different planet."
Well, the planet of Vermont.
Well, you can email us, too, at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
We're also asking you to help us create a healthcare glossary. What healthcare term do you want to know more about? Death panels? Is that a healthcare term? Healthcare co-ops? What do you think? What's your own definition? Or is there another word you want to find? Give us that too. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We'll answer your questions on air and online. And if a public option gets dropped from the healthcare reform, here's your takeaway.
There's a fear that that would kill the private insurers. They couldn't compete because of this big government subsidy. So the co-op is a compromise saying, well, how about a semi-government plan? Think of it as halfway there. Going to be regulated, but not quite government-run.
That's bioethicist Art Kaplan from the University of Pennsylvania. And on our website, thetakeaway.org, you can also subscribe if you missed anything. We're always here on The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm Andrea Bernstein.
I'm Amy Holmes. You've been listening to The Takeaway.
Remember when President Obama seemed to have it all wrapped up? Here I am, I'm still living on your... Just about exactly a year ago, he was getting ready to accept his nomination in front of 80,000 people in a stadium in Denver and begin his march to victory. But the healthcare reform campaign? Not exactly signed, sealed, delivered. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 18th. John Hockenberry is away. I'm Amy Holmes, and I'm here with Andrea Bernstein.
Good morning, Amy. Coming up, a psychologist on the new Army program to help improve the mental health of soldiers. Can you believe that there's never been one up to now?
Hard to believe.
Comedian Andy Borowitz talks up the new season of Dancing with the Stars, and we'll explore what kind of speech crosses the line online. But first, we're here with Raihan Salam, a fellow at the New America Foundation. Raihan, why does Obama's health care reform campaign seem to be unraveling?
I think a lot of Americans are losing. They're worried about losing what they have, and they also feel disempowered.
Raihan, stay with us. We'll be back with you in a moment. But first, a look at today's top headlines.
Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak will be in the White House today. He's expected to argue for Israel to freeze settlement activity in the West Bank. Meanwhile, Israel has stopped giving the green light to new building projects in the West Bank. That's according to Israeli government officials who spoke to the Associated Press. However, the government is still publicly refusing to honor a U.S. request to officially freeze settlement building.
In Afghanistan, a suicide bomber has targeted a NATO convoy in Kabul. At least 7 people have been killed and dozens more wounded. 2 UN staff members are thought to be among the dead. Meanwhile, NATO says it will halt offensives in Afghanistan during the country's presidential election on Thursday. Instead, NATO troops will be stationed around the country to help protect voters. And in financial news, some new economic indicators just in this past hour. The producer price index dropped 0.9% in July. That drop is 3 times bigger than analysts predicted. Meanwhile, construction of new homes dipped last month 1%.
The U.S. Army is planning to require all soldiers to undergo intensive mental stress training to take part in the wars there. It's meant to stop mental health problems, including depression and post-traumatic stress disorder.
Hurricane Bill is getting bigger out in the Atlantic. Right now, the storm is 300 miles across. It may come close to hitting Bermuda by the week's end.
In the U.S., only 45 million doses of the H1N1 vaccine will be ready by October. That's less than half of what was initially predicted. The government says it's because of a shortage due to manufacturing issues. Andrea?
On Wall Street yesterday, all major indices fell by more than 2%. The Dow starts trading today at 91.35. The S&P kicks off at 9.80. The Nasdaq opens at 19.31. And here at The Takeaway, we're creating a healthcare glossary. Amy, what healthcare term would you like to find?
Co-op?
Okay. Maybe you have your own definition for a phrase you've been hearing. Give us that definition. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. The thing that I want to know is, you know, death tax. Remember the death tax?
Death
that
tax?
Was the estate tax.
Death
the death
penalty,
panel.
Death
That's
panel.
A good term.
Death is not a good word to
the
put
Democrats
into public
need
policy.
To own death.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Andrea Bernstein in with Amy Holmes. John Hockenberry is away. Amy, do you know where you were a year ago today?
I seem to recall that I was up at the Time Warner Center here in New York City looking toward the Democratic Convention for CNN.
I know exactly where I was. I was on the road to the convention somewhere on Route 70 in Ohio. And at that time, Barack Obama's future was looking pretty bright. But even with the same brilliant political minds that orchestrated his campaign for president.
David Axelrod.
Rahm Emanuel, Bill Burton, Robert Gibbs, et cetera, et cetera. All these brilliant people working in the White House now. Many of them worked on his campaign. Obama's health care campaign isn't working out the way his presidential campaign has. Now, is this a blip? Is this something gone terribly wrong for the White House? Joining us to talk about it, back with us, is Raihan Salam of the New America Foundation. Raihan, great to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
So why does it feel like this is all sort of coming apart for Barack Obama when so much in his political life and his administration has gone so well?
I think that, as you suggest, these guys are tremendously bright, but I think they made some basic miscalculations about the anxieties of the public. And I think that what the public fears most is losing what they have. The sad fact is that, you know, as the administration has argued, a lot of people will inevitably lose what they have under the status quo, but they haven't done a very good job of reassuring the public, in part because they've been thinking too politically rather than about educating the public and educating the public about difficult trade-offs that have to be made.
Now, when you talk about thinking politically, I mean, the Republicans must feel like it's Christmas in August. Things haven't been going so well for the Republicans. There have been scandals. There's been Sarah Palin resigning her governorship. There's been all kinds of hand-wringing about who's going to be the, you know, flag bearer for the GOP. And then
and
suddenly...
don't forget Sanford in Argentina.
Oh, yeah. Excuse me. How could I forget the big news, you know, affairs in Buenos Aires. And we'll be talking about tangoing in just a minute, Dancing with the Stars. I don't think Mark Sanford is quite yet ready for that, though. But Tom DeLay is. So stranger things have happened. But, you know, talking about the Republican Party, I mean, it's just, it's, you know, everybody was sort of like, oh, it's all going so badly. And then all of a sudden, you have this, you know, these people showing up at these town hall meetings and peppering these Democrats, and it looking like the Republicans have some of this grassroots momentum that Barack Obama seemed to be doing so well getting in his corner.
I mean, forget about, you know, town hall meetings. You actually have a situation where Arlen Specter is now running behind Patrick Toomey in Pennsylvania. Pat Toomey, a very conservative Republican who before wasn't barely on the map. No one thought it was even imaginable that he'd be within a mile of Arlen Specter. So I think that the Republicans are in a very awkward spot. They have this great political opportunity to deliver a fatal blow to the president, or so they think. On the other hand, they're doing things right now that are going to undermine their long-term policy objectives. So I think that, yes, they're able to get some political hay out of this now, but it's in a way that I think is going to cause them problems.
But let's shift focus back to President Obama. Rasmussen has Obama's approvals at below 50%. We can see in polling data that, in fact, the public thinks the deficit is the number one problem, not healthcare, and healthcare will explode the deficit. This is part of the unease about his plan. You say, you know, his team miscalculated, but couldn't they see this coming like a train on the tracks?
I think in a funny way they did see it coming. In the beginning when they were talking about healthcare, they were talking about bending the cost curve. They were talking about how their reforms are going to deliver a more sustainable fiscal future for the country. But then they saw that, you know what, there are a lot of contradictions in that message. And it turns out that coverage expansion, which was the heart of their policy agenda, is actually very, very expensive. And, you know, yet they're emphasizing sort of reducing costs. So that was an initial, you know, confusion, source of confusion for the public. Then they start emphasizing health insurance reform, we're going to make your insurance better. And I think that that, in a way, might have been a better and more effective political message initially. Yet again, people are, you know, wondering, how exactly are you going to make this happen? Is this very plausible? They wanted to move very quickly because they thought, you know, we have this huge majority, let's use shock and awe, let's push this through very aggressively, stay united. But then they found that, you know, with blue dogs asking questions, with the public asking questions, it wasn't possible for them to move this as quickly as they wanted to. And so as those questions emerged, as they became louder, then that political strategy started to fall apart.
Joining us now is Melissa Harris-Lacewell. She's a professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton University. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, it's great to talk to you again. And, of course, we're still talking with Raihan Salam of the New America Foundation. Melissa Harris-Lacewell, we've been talking about President Obama and why he seemed to be able to run such a great political campaign, but why his health care reform campaign doesn't seem to be going so well. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, they're certainly very different kinds of campaigns. You know, when we're talking about an election, it has everything to do with the candidate and a sense of kind of emotional connection, affective excitement about the candidate, and his capacity really as a candidate to create the sense that he was on everyone's side at the same time. I mean, maybe not absolutely everyone, but a very broad cross-section of Americans, so that you had, in fact, an unusually large electoral coalition behind him as a, you know, moderate Democratic candidate. Governing is, of course, a different story, because in the context of actually passing policy, it becomes clearer who the winners and losers are, who will be asked to sacrifice and who won't, and there's less of the kind of affective, emotional element of kind of policymaking campaigning. So many of his strengths aren't applicable here.
But Professor, do you think it's possible that what we're seeing, what you're describing, is something that, you know, sort of the McCain and Hillary Clinton people were talking about during the campaign, which is he doesn't really know how to govern, he's inexperienced?
Oh, no, not at all. I think it's just the difference between, electoral campaigning versus governing work. It doesn't strike me as a incapacity to do the governing, but rather that it's a different kind of governing. And in fact, of course, part of what's happening here is that on the left and on the so he's very much in the center, maybe even the center right. The left has nowhere to go in the context of an election, but suddenly has the ability to be critiquing from the left on this health care plan, as well as, of course, a very vocal opposition coming from the right.
Professor, this is Amy Holmes here, and I have to give a shout out as a fellow Tiger, Princeton graduate myself. President Obama campaigned, though, against George Bush's own deficits, and yet he has been proposing gargantuan spending that is making a lot of citizens really nervous. I think of a previous president, George Bush, who said, read my lips, no new taxes, and he got very punished for breaking that campaign promise. What about Barack Obama?
Well, you know, I have to say that in this case, I'm not certain that it really is the deficit or the spending that is making Americans this anxious. You know, clearly we were willing in the context of a post 9/11 America to spend whatever we felt was necessary to keep us safe, because we felt that terrorism was a real threat and that expenditures on it in the context of the war were acceptable expenditures and that we were willing to go into debt for them. In this case, I think we have to develop a similar sense that public health, the sense of our capacity as a nation for everyone to be covered, everyone to have access to health care, is similarly emergent, that we have a responsibility to find a way to pay for it. Americans are not necessarily opposed to deficit spending. Our anxiety has to do with our sense of whether or not we think that spending is fair and appropriate and in the national interest.
Raihan Salam, I'm wondering if this healthcare debate is bringing up sort of a fundamental contradiction in the American psyche, which is that Americans really, you know, care about each other, and yet when they think about government action, they get very worried about socialism. Do you think that's what's going on here?
I think that's a really profound issue. I think that when you're looking at coverage expansion under this framework wherein most people are going to keep, or most people are in theory going to keep, their employer-based coverage, it's very awkward, because when you have new funding streams, they're not going to you, the median voter who has employer-based coverage. It's going to some other group of people. And I think there's this anxiety about, well, you know, those are my tax dollars, or is that money going to be used wisely? And I think that there is a certain kind of resentment, and I think that sometimes it's expressed as opposition to socialism. One thing I wanted to say regarding Professor Harris-Lacewell's remark, which I thought was very astute, is this idea that I think that the Obama folks are very interested in a broad politics. They're very interested in transcending antagonisms. So initially, they really emphasize the support of big insurers and big corporations for insurance reform. Yet actually, the public really resisted that idea. I do disagree, however, on this question of debt and deficit. I think that it actually is something that's proved very, very potent for people, far more potent now than it did in circa, 2001, 2002. But yeah, I think that that anxiety about socialism is really about, well, we're under straitened circumstances now. We have fewer resources. And how are those resources going to be shared?
Thanks very much, Raihan Salam, fellow at the New America Foundation, and Melissa Harris-Lacewell, professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton University. You know, Amy, I am unconvinced that deficit and debt in the end really moves American voters. I know that's something that people worry about, but I don't know in the end whether people actually pull the lever.
It's an interesting question. It's been polled as the top one concern, and I think healthcare raises real questions about the relationship of the individual to government.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Live from Hollywood, this is Dancing with the Stars.
Okay, Andrea, Donny Osmond, Tom DeLay, Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Sounds like a strange brew?
That's right.
Well, they're all going to be on the new season of Dancing with the Stars, and here to discuss
You're not
that
up?
No, is Andy Borowitz. He's a humorist and blogger behind BorowitzReport.com. He also writes for The New Yorker. So, Tom DeLay and Sequins, have you been waiting for this moment?
Actually, I really think, not to put too much emphasis on the importance, cultural importance of Dancing with the Stars, but it really is kind of a good template for Barack Obama's healthcare proposal because, think about it, Dancing with the Stars, every American in this country, regardless of their background, where they live, what they've accomplished, is entitled to be on Dancing with the Stars.
What do you mean by that? You have to be a star.
No,
Andy.
No. This show really not only redefines dancing, it redefines star, especially when you look at that list of the people who are going to be on the show next year.
Are you saying Aaron Carter's little brother isn't a star?
No. Aaron Carter, now, Amy, you've already sort of illustrated the point. Aaron Carter's little brother does not exist. Nick Carter's little brother is Aaron Carter. And Aaron Carter, I can't believe you don't remember the fantastic hit song, Oh Aaron, which was Aaron Carter's, I guess, one claim to fame, besides being Nick Carter's
I think he also
brother.
Dated Lindsay Lohan.
He did? Okay. Well, then I would say his credentials to be on Dancing with the Stars are secure, I would have to say.
I see. But, you know, haven't people actually used this show to relaunch their careers? I mean, Marie Osmond, where was she before she fainted on Dancing with the Stars?
On Dancing with the Stars. You know, I'm very, very queasy about using terms like relaunch to describe any of the careers that have sort of come. It's more, I think, these stars or whoever, I don't know, what should we call these people? They're not really stars. I guess we need sort of a cosmologist to explain what is a star that's kind of half burned out. It's something else. It's not a star. It's not a nova.
A red star.
A red star. I think what it is
a black
is that,
hole?
You know, these are people who some
That's
of them.
Kind of the healthcare reform debate.
Exactly. These are people who have kind of fallen out of our consciousness. And this is a chance to kind of reintroduce.
But who want to elbow their way back in.
They want to get back in. And I think Dancing with the Stars and a lot of these reality shows that feature kind of semi or former celebrities, these are sort of halfway houses where they're brought back into our midst, and we're supposed to try to determine whether we can tolerate them.
So, to use your metaphor, if they're halfway houses, are they sort of substance abusers of fame?
Well, a little bit. Yeah,
let's get a little literary.
A little literary, since I write for the New Yorker. They're people that can't. Like the rest of us, they can't stand to live normal lives where they just sort of go to the post office and do
I need
things
the pop.
Normal.
No, wait, are we talking about the contestants now or the, and I'm using quotes, but no one can see it with my fingers, stars?
Well, for those of you who've never watched the show, and I think that there are probably people in this room who that applies to, Dancing with the Stars, the concept
I
is.
I confess.
It's the takeaway question.
It's the takeaway question. What is Dancing
Have you ever
with
watched
the Stars?
It?
Dancing with the Stars, the concept is very simple. It's a dance contest, and each couple Dancing Couple features one professional dancer who we're not supposed to know who they are because they're known only for their dancing. So they actually, these people have something on TV which is called talent. It's a very unfamiliar concept on reality shows. They're paired with somebody who's just known for being famous. In other words, a star as defined
like
by
the Tom
show.
DeLay.
Like Tom DeLay, absolutely, or the aforementioned Aaron Carter. So it's these pairings of an actual dancer and a actual quote-unquote star, and that's who we're, you know, we just got this big announcement yesterday that Tom DeLay is going to be one of them. And Tom DeLay is following a tradition of, now I understand he's somebody you know, and I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to diss
Tom DeLay.
You don't know Tom DeLay?
No,
Never danced? We've never danced with Tom DeLay.
Well, I can't talk about that on the radio.
I interviewed him once.
You did, okay. I actually have met Tom DeLay, so maybe I am actually the closest to Tom DeLay on this panel.
I think I chased him once down the street yelling,
okay.
Mr. DeLay.
Well, he's doing what he is indicted currently. That's correct. And a lot of, shall we say, disgraced politicians will appear on shows, will appear on TV, as a way of sort of edging back into the public consciousness. And if they appear to be good sports, then maybe we will also forgive them some.
Seems
of their
like a
past
pretty good idea though, right?
Yeah.
But let's be fair to this particular show. It is immensely popular.
Absolutely.
My parents love to watch it. It's multi-generational. So, unlike a lot of reality shows, it actually has caught the imagination of a lot of American viewers. Why?
You know, I think that one thing is it serves a couple of needs. First of all, we like dancing. Who doesn't like dancing? We've all grown up enjoying that phenomenon. But also, it's kind of an interesting test of our memory because we spend a lot of the show trying to remember who these people are, and I think that's good. That's sort of a good kind of contest for us in a way.
And that's your takeaway from this. Andy Borowitz, humorist and blogger behind the BorowitzReport.com. Time now for some headlines from Amy.
And I know I'll be straining to remember just who is Aaron Carter.
And who's his little brother? Does he have a little sister?
Nick, Aaron, I don't know. But President Obama, meanwhile, is meeting with Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak at the White House today. On the agenda, Arab-Israeli peace negotiations and the effort to stop Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons. This marks the first White House talks with the leader in more than 5 years. Meanwhile, Israel has stopped giving the green light to new building projects in the West Bank. That's according to Israeli government officials who spoke to the Associated Press. However, the government is still publicly refusing to honor a U.S. request to officially stop. U.S. health officials say there won't be a shortage of the H1N1 vaccine, but there will be a delay. Only 45 million doses will be ready by mid-October, although 120 million were expected. Dr. Bruce Gellin, head of the National Vaccine Program, says it's a manufacturing issue.
The basic problem is that these vaccines are made with living viruses, and the viruses have to grow in these systems. They're grown in eggs, and every year we have to make sure that the viruses do what the best that they can in growing in eggs. It was initially somewhat disappointing that this virus wasn't growing so well.
Dr. Gellin spoke to CBS earlier today. After the initial delay, 20 million doses are expected to be delivered weekly from October 15th onward.
The first hurricane of the Atlantic season is expected to become a major storm in the next couple of days, with winds topping 110 miles per hour. Hurricane Bill may hit near Bermuda by the end of the week. There's no word yet on whether the Category 2 storm threatens the eastern United States. Pakistan says they're holding the man believed to be a top spokesperson for the Pakistani Taliban. The detainee claims that Taliban leader Batula Masood was killed in a CIA strike in August.
And those are just some of the news stories we're watching today. Coming up, Andrea, you know how the Army is helping soldiers prepare mentally for combat? It's interesting. They're turning a technique mostly used on kids on soldiers. We'll find out more in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Andrea Bernstein here with Amy Holmes. Now, Amy, the Army is starting a new program to train soldiers to improve their mental health because up to now they didn't need this, right?
I was going to say, this is new?
Right. It's kind of surprising. Joining us is one of the people in charge of these programs, Karen Rivich. She's the co-director of the Penn Resiliency Project and a research associate in the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And also joining us is Ben Carey. He's a reporter for The New York Times, our partner, and he's writing about this program in today's paper. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, Ben, let's start with you. I guess the most shocking thing to me about this is that the Army has never done this before. Why not?
Well, the Army's interested in training warriors, and so it's somewhat treacherous for them to start talking about the emotional side and emotional stress. I mean, they're training people, men and women, to be confident and aggressive. And it's tricky once you start talking about emotions and you know, the possibility of sort of emotional consequences from trauma. I mean, you don't want people thinking that they're fragile, that they might have a problem. You don't want to put that in their heads. And most don't. Most do very well. So for the Army, they're interested in talking about this from a position of strength, of resilience, of mental toughness, rather than the possibility of mental problems.
And yet, Karen Rivich, I mean, it's kind of surprising, I suppose, that you would need to train soldiers in mental health and that you've been doing this with school children. Can you tell us about how you implement a program for a soldier and how it's worked out with kids?
Yeah, well, our work with children, which we've been doing for about 20 years, has shown that we can prevent depression and anxiety in adolescents and young adults. And so what we're doing with our colleagues in the Army is to take this program that has been effective in the civilian world and making sure it's relevant for soldiers, making sure the curriculum is exactly right. And the goal of it, as Ben has said, is to help set them up for dealing with all the everyday stressors that we all confront in life, plus the extra stressors that our soldiers have to confront. So we're teaching them how to challenge very negative thinking that might get in their way. We teach them how to stop themselves from catastrophizing so that they're still able to stay task-focused. And a big part of the program is about positive communication, so how they can talk to their families and their loved ones and keep those relationships strong when they're overseas with these long deployments.
Karen, this is Amy Holmes here. Just to like be very specific when you talk about the curriculum, and I don't mean to be glib, but are you teaching soldiers to say, you know, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like me? What
and you could
mean?
Be senator if you say that.
Yeah, absolutely not. I mean, I'm glad you asked that. These are strategies that are based on science. So this is not Pollyanna optimism. It's how to marshal concrete evidence to prove to yourself when you have a very dire negative belief, to prove to yourself that that's not wholly true and that you're able to cope with a situation at hand. So these are serious skills. It's not looking in the mirror and repeating happy phrases.
So, Ben, how does this compare to soldier training of that you're in the field and this is how you you solve problems?
This whole piece of it, I think, was sort of left unstated. I mean, the military, as I understand it, is, you know, focused on discipline, on tactics, on physical fitness. And the mental side of it was something that the soldier kind of learned on the fly or as they were training. There's a kind of weeding out process that happens in basic training. Soldiers who can handle it and perform well, that was thought to be the best sign of good mental health.
Sort of the take it like a man. Take it like a soldier.
Take it like a man.
Right.
Exactly.
As a matter of fact, in your article, you say that the Army didn't even want to admit that they were doing this until you contacted them. I mean, it wasn't like they tried to publicize it.
No, that's not quite correct. Someone working with them did contact me. I think they want this out there. They want this publicized. They believe it's important for the public to know, I think, that they are doing something. They're thinking about it. They now have soldiers who are going to be deployed for third and fourth times. I don't know if this has ever happened in wars of that many deployments in a row. So they're stretched. They're sort of setting up for long-term ideological struggle. And they are concerned about their soldiers, about retention, about the family members now who have to watch their sons and daughters and spouses go out repeatedly. And so I think they wanted this out there. They wanted credit for it, and they want support for it.
So, Ben, is this specific to the Army? Like, for example, I know fighter pilots are put through a lot of stress training, like including if they were to be captured by the enemy and put under torture. Is this a different program for this particular branch of the military?
Well, no, I'm not an expert in this. I think this is the first of its kind that is so comprehensive and intensive. You're referring to interrogation techniques. That's a short course that's given, I think, to across most of the services. This is a longer-term course that the idea is you start in basic training. You're getting refreshers as you go through the Army. If you have a career in the Army, you'll be getting it as you go along, as you move up the ranks.
Karen Rivich, we need to just wrap up now, but I just wanted to ask you, do you think this will be effective? I mean, there's been a lot of talk about mental health problems among soldiers. Do you think that this is going to really change things?
I absolutely do. I mean, we need to do research, and we need to learn from the research, but I am very confident that it'll be effective.
Thank you so much, Karen Rivich, the co-director of the Penn Resiliency Project and a research associate in the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and Ben Carey, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Now let's check in on some of the stories we're watching this morning, Amy.
Construction on new homes and apartments dipped 1% last month. That's worse than an analyst had predicted. Construction of single-family homes did rise, though, by a little. The government says production problems mean it will only have 45 million doses of the H1N1 vaccine ready by mid-October. That's far short of the 120 million doses it had expected. The government says it's just a delay, however, and not a shortage. 20 million more doses should ship out each week after that.
Overseas, Israel has put a temporary hold on new building projects in the West Bank. That's according to the Israeli government officials who spoke to the Associated Press. Officially, Israel has refused to honor a request from the U.S. to stop all construction there. Back in the U.S., a Texas judge who's on trial for indirectly blocking a death row inmate's last-minute appeal plans to testify in her own case. Judge Sharon Keller is accused of refusing to extend her court's hours to accommodate the lawyers for the inmate. Keller could take the stand as early as today.
And finally, a new study shows that simple painkillers may be better than prescription meds for kids with broken arms. Researchers at the Medical College of Wisconsin found that children on ibuprofen were more likely to play, ate better, and experienced few negative side effects. The study is out today on the online edition of the Annals of Emergency Medicine. That's just a look at some of the top stories coming up. What counts as free speech if it's on the internet? We're going to hear about a case that really tests those limits coming up in about 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm Andrea Bernstein. President Obama is set to meet today with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. By many accounts, it'll be a tense visit. Obama is pushing Egypt to make small but important concessions towards Israel. But will Egypt play ball? We're here with Michael Slackman. He's a reporter for The New York Times, our partners, and he is in Cairo. Great to talk to you again, Michael.
Nice to be back.
Michael, what's the view there from Egypt? What is Egypt hoping to get from the meeting today?
Well, I think Egypt is telling President Obama the same thing that they were saying in the final years of the Bush administration, which is we have to deal with the final most important issues, put it all on the table. That would be the status of Jerusalem. That would be the issue of refugees returning or not returning or how to deal with them from Israel. And then all of the other more immediate issues, settlements, the situation in Gaza, and the situation in the West Bank.
Michael, the last time you and I talked was right after President Obama's speech there in Cairo at the beginning of the summer. At the time, there was a lot of reaction that you were getting, that there was a lot of good talk, but people wanted to see actions. Has anything changed since then?
Well, not a lot has changed, although I think President Obama still has a great deal of goodwill. They like him. They like that he's talking. They like that he has solicited the Arab opinion. But, yes, people need to see concrete changes. And from the Arab perspective, they feel that Israel has to go first, that Israel needs to demonstrate that it is in support of peace. The Arabs have issued for several years now, since 2002, their own peace proposal. They want to see Israel, as I said, freeze settlements, ease up on Gaza, improve the economic conditions within the West Bank, and have a agree to have negotiations with all the issues on the table, including the sensitive issues.
Michael Slackman, this is Amy Holmes here. You're talking about what Arabs want to see from Israelis. What do they want to see from Palestinians?
Well, the main thing that Egypt is doing right now in terms of the peace process is they're trying to negotiate a settlement between the warring factions among the Palestinians. As you know, the Gaza Strip is controlled by Hamas. Fatah continues to control the West Bank. They've been pretty much going at it, you know, not with guns at the moment, but politically speaking, they've been going at it, and Egypt is trying to reconcile. President Mubarak, his position and the establishment, his position is you can't really move forward on the peace process until the Palestinians are united. So that's what they've been working for.
How big a deal is this White House visit in Egypt? I mean, Mubarak hasn't been here for a while. Relationships with Bush were very tense, to say the least. What is the sort of meaning in Egypt of this visit?
Well, nobody is expecting a eureka moment. They see this as an important step in the process, and they're hopeful that they can come away from this meeting with not necessarily an agreement, but perhaps an incremental development. You know, there was tremendous frustration, and I would add even fear here, at the way the Bush administration handled the process, at least for its first 6 years. They pretty much turned away from this and didn't focus on it. And for the moment, anyway, this type of activity is seen as doing something. You know what I mean? Just the very fact that they're talking and negotiating and they're on the ground, and President Obama and his administration have made clear they care about this. The next step will have to be concrete changes.
And that is going to be our takeaway. Thanks very much, Michael Slackman, from our reporter, from our partners in the New York Times. It's always great to talk to you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Amy Holmes with Andrea Bernstein. We're filling in for John Hockenberry, the dynamic duo. Coming up, we're going to learn about a case that's testing where free speech ends on the internet. Like, what kind of vicious things can you say and get away with it? That's just in a few moments. We're also creating a healthcare glossary. What healthcare term do you want to know more about? Andrea, death panels.
I'm not co-ops. Sure. Right, death panels is obviously a term of art. Healthcare co-ops. We'd like to know what people want to know more about.
Well, we want to hear what your own definition is for a phrase that you've been hearing. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth from New Jersey, and the first term in my healthcare glossary is preventative. Forget all of these pharmaceutical companies and all of these medicines. The first way to get rid of obesity, cancers, heart attacks is through natural lifestyle changes.
Wow, those are some of the hardest to do, actually, lifestyle
preventative.
Changes.
There's a $5 word.
So please call us with your healthcare definitions or questions at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now a look at today's top news stories. Andrea, can you kick us off?
In financial news, wholesale inflation dropped 0.9% in July. That drop is three times bigger than analysts predicted. The company that owns Reader's Digest is filing for bankruptcy. Well, the company says it'll make a move within a month, but doesn't expect to stop publishing Reader's Digest in the U.S. or to lay off employees.
I was going to say, what would dentist offices do without Reader's Digest?
President Obama is scheduled to meet with former President Bill Clinton this afternoon at the White House. The two are expected to discuss President Clinton's recent trip to North Korea, where he met with leader Kim Jong-il and helped secure the release of two American journalists.
Health officials say the expected 120 million doses of the H1N1 vaccine will not arrive on time. Just 45 million doses will be available by mid-October, with 20 million more scheduled to arrive weekly after that. Hurricane Bill, not Bill Clinton, but an actual hurricane, is expected to become a major storm in the next couple of days, with winds topping 110 miles per hour. No word yet on whether the Category 2 storm will endanger the United States.
And former South Korean President Kim Dae-jung died of heart failure at the age of 85. Kim won the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to reconcile with the communist North Korea. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching today.
So, Andrew, we're going to be talking about the limits of free speech online. When is it okay to write on your blog, "I hate this person, I think something bad should happen to them," and when does it cross the line so you can actually be brought up on charges? You know, these are interesting, difficult cases, and there's one that's testing the limits. Let's bring in Anna Sale, the Capital Region reporter for WNPR in Connecticut, to discuss. Anna, how did a New Jersey blogger end up in a federal prison?
Well, it's been sort of interesting. Hal Turner is a blogger and an internet radio host who broadcasts from his New Jersey home. And he showed up in Connecticut because he blogged in early June about a bill that would give lay members in the Catholic Church more authority. And just before he posted the blog, the ethics officials in the state said they were going to investigate the Catholic Church on whether or not they violated lobby laws by organizing some rallies at the Capitol while this bill was being debated. The bill since died. Hal Turner posted on his blog, the specific language was he called it an assault on the Catholic Church. He named two of the lawmakers who were considering this bill, named the ethics official by name, and said it was time to take up arms and put down this tyranny by force. And he went on to say, quote, "It's our intent to foment direct action against these individuals personally. These beastly government officials should be made an example of as a warning to others in government, obey the Constitution or die."
He added, "Let me be the first to say this plainly, these judges deserve to be killed."
That was in the second case, actually. The same day he blogged about the Connecticut case, he blogged about three federal judges in Illinois who unanimously upheld Chicago's ban on handguns. And he said, like you said, plainly, "These judges deserve to be killed.
Their blood will replenish the tree of liberty, a small price to pay." Now, this raises a lot of difficult free speech issues, and that's why we have brought in Paul Butler, law professor at George Washington University and author of A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice, along with Siva Vaidyanathan, professor of media studies at the Law of University of Virginia. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. So, Paul, I want to address this first to you, which is this crossing the line of free speech if you blog ugly things?
Andre, it's a really close case. Under the First Amendment, you're allowed to have a violent, racist fantasy. You're even allowed to say that you wish somebody was dead. What you're not allowed to do is to make a threat, which is what Mr. Turner's charged with doing. And threat means you have to have the intent for imminent violence, and your act has to be reasonably likely to produce that violence. And so that's going to be the question for the judge, first of all, to determine under the law whether Mr. Turner's conduct is protected by the Constitution.
But isn't that exactly where it becomes so difficult, which is to determine both intent and the imminence of the threat? I mean, when Hal Turner goes on his blog and he says these things that I think we can all agree are outrageous, how do we know that he says, "Go and do that tomorrow"?
Well, that's the difficult factual determination that the jury will have to undertake. And so it'll look at circumstantial evidence, like the fact that he posted office addresses, photographs. And some of his statements, they could lead to either conclusion. And sometimes he says, "Well, gee, I hope nobody does anything." And other times he almost seems to encourage some kind of action.
So, Siva, I want to bring you into this conversation. You are a professor of media studies at UVA. What is it about the internet that seems to provoke or allow people to write these ugly things?
Well, that it's filled with people. We are a bunch of animals who like to write and promote ugly things. That's not news, nor is it particularly special in our day and age. In fact, I think it's safe to say that we have far fewer violent racists in America than we've ever had. So the rise of the internet probably has neither cause nor effect on that phenomenon.
So it's just sort of ripping the veil of civility from us, that we get to be anonymous and show our true sort of human nature?
No, but what we have is what we're experiencing is what internet theorist Clay Shirky calls filter failure, which is the fact that in a radically democratic medium, you get all sorts of ideas that would normally not pass your field of vision in an older, more filtered environment coming up. But that doesn't mean that it's creating or fostering any sort of new way of thinking. I think we make a big mistake by focusing on the medium rather than the message. What we have here is a classic case, although as Paul says, not a slam dunk case, of a hateful person making what are pretty close to serious threats against government officials, including federal judges in Chicago, and we should expect and demand that the FBI take that seriously and that the Justice Department pursue it, and that's exactly what's happening. So there's nothing surprising about the criminal element of this case. Hold on for just one moment,
because I do want to get back to Professor Butler on this. You know, when we were talking about this story amongst ourselves yesterday afternoon, one of the issues that came up is that once you put this on the internet, it never goes away. And is there any legal recourse to get it taken down?
Well, I think it has gone down.
Under the First Amendment, that would be really difficult. You know, the problem is that nobody wants to punish anyone for their thinking, for bad thoughts. We want to punish people for acts, but at this point it looks more like a bad thought maybe than an act. So the question is, how close does the guy have to get? Do you have to have somebody driving to the state house or the courthouse with a gun? Do you have to wait until they cock the gun before the law can intervene? So clearly at some point before something really imminent and bad happens, there's a criminal case. The question is how close is close?
So it's such an interesting question, particularly in this internet age. How close is close? I want to thank you all for joining us. We had Anna Sale, Capital Region reporter for WNPR in Connecticut, Paul Butler, law professor at George Washington University and author of A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice, and Siva Vidyathan, professor of media studies and law at University of Virginia. Thank you all for joining us.
Tell us what you think of free speech on the internet. Go to our website at www.thetakeaway.org. While you're there, you can subscribe to our podcast so you'll never miss a minute of the show. Subscribe at thetakeaway.org. We're also creating a healthcare glossary and need your help. What healthcare term do you want to know more about? Maybe you have your own definition for a phrase you've been hearing. Give that to us, too. Martina in Kankakee, Illinois, called to clarify that healthcare, medical treatment, and health insurance are all different things.
Lumping all these together as healthcare has created very basic, instinctual, and emotional responses to any perceived threats to physical well-being or financial status when we do not operate from common definitions or understanding.
Give us your take at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE, 1-877-8-MY-TAKE, or thetakeaway.org. Tell us what you think. How do you think healthcare compares? I'm Andrea Bernstein.
I'm Amy Holmes.
This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.